From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Catherine Dion, whose new book is The Dependence, published by Little Brown. Catherine Dion was born in Oakland, California. She is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where she was awarded the Iowa Arts Fellowship. She has also been a McDowell Fellow and the recipient of a grant from the Elizabeth George Foundation. She lives in Berkeley, California. The Dependence is her first novel. Here's a little bit of information about the book. After the sudden death of his wife, Maida, Gene is haunted by the fear that the marriage was not all it appeared to be. Alongside Ed and Gail Donnelly, friends since college days, he tries to resurrect happy memories of the times the two couples shared, raising their children in a small New Hampshire town and vacationing together at a lake house every summer. Meanwhile, his daughter, Dari, challenges not only his happy version of the past, but also his view of Maida. As a long-standing rift between them deepens, Gene starts to understand how unknown his daughter is to him and how enigmatic his wife was as well. And a lingering suspicion seizes his mind that could upend everything he thought he knew. When I spoke with Catherine Dion, I began by asking her how The Dependence started for her. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I was really interested in writing about father-daughter relationships. I felt that I hadn't seen a book recently or maybe for quite some time that really looked at the question of how adult fathers and adult daughters related to each other. And that was that interest in part stemmed from my own relationship with my father, who I realized I had grown up in California, moved away for 10 years, and I moved back and as an adult, and I realized there was a lot that I didn't know about my own father. And I started to think about the way that especially in a parent-child relationship, the nature of that parent-child dynamic is incredibly dominating. And so that it's hard to see around that particular dynamic, even as one ages and that the nature of that dynamic changes. And so I was really left with a profound sense of, well, here is someone with whom I have had perhaps one of the deepest and most intimate and profound connections of my life, and yet felt that I didn't know much about my father and his inner life and his childhood. And I was not interested in writing about our relationship in particular, but it really did stoke my curiosity in thinking about the way I watched other adult children interacting with their parents and was just became very curious about the mystery that can be in parent-child relationships, even though I think culturally we assume that parents really know something deep about their children and vice versa, which I would say is true, but there's also a lot they don't know about each other. And so what was interesting to me is that I started writing about this father-daughter relationship, and I had actually made the mother deceased in the early drafts of the book because I wanted to focus on that relationship. And I had this misguided idea that if the mother wasn't in the picture, that somehow I could really put my attention on these two characters, the father and the daughter, without the mother's interference. and this is where fiction takes on a life of its own. And what I kept discovering was, in part because of the distance between the father and daughter, which I didn't really understand from the beginning. It was just there in the book.
Right.
And very early on, there was just a clear triangulation between the Gene's wife and his daughter and Dari's mother and her father. And that seemed key to understanding the relationships between all of the characters. And then another significant event in my personal life that happened as I was writing the book was that I had a very dear friend die. She committed suicide. And as suicide often is, it creates a particularly plangent kind of grief where lots of questions come up. And I was really sidelined by my grief and had to put the book aside, work on the book aside during this period. Mm-hmm. And was very close to her family and ended up having a conversation with her father that where he asked me a question about her, about my friend Jenny, I couldn't answer, which led me on the path of conducting interviews with a number of the other people in her life who loved her and knew her quite well. And in the process of doing those interviews, I had a really eye-opening experience of encountering the fact that the version of her that I knew was not the version that everyone else knew. And I don't mean at all to suggest that she led a double life or she had extreme secrets from people in her life, but just really encountering that sense of who we are with each person in our lives is different every time we meet. And so then I had this experience of having to really face that my memories of her were not these concrete things that would exist as they always existed and would remain unchanged. And in fact, some of the ways I remembered her were immediately challenged by conducting these interviews. And that process of going through a deep grief while at the same time having all kinds of fear and doubt and uncertainty and a desire to hold on to what I had, even as I watched it slip away and be changed. I think that all of that pretty clearly entered the book I was writing about, and it became a very different book as a result.
Yeah, I was really struck by the extent that Gene has doubt about his sort of about his relationship with Maida, his wife who has died, and doubt about who he is, and also an inability to retrieve experience once it has passed, and an inability to continue knowing a person once she has died. And that really came through. And now your story helps me understand how you came to that. It reminds me a little bit of when people write memoir, a lot of times they talk about once they put a thing in writing, then it's set in that kind of stone, and it limits the amount to which our memories of a person can change. But in a sense, what you're saying is there's a lack of change that can happen once our memories are even set in our minds.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's so interesting. In speaking about the dependence, so initially, Jean's memories of courtship and marriage are very hopeful and nostalgic early in the book. That's how I found them anyway. But as he begins to work on his wife's eulogy, doubt starts to creep in. And I thought that was really interesting. The first words he can come up with for the eulogy are "something definite was lost," which, you know, obviously is not hopeful and nostalgic. I'm curious, as you worked, did the eulogy sort of work as kind of a fulcrum for you on which his experience of his marriage began to turn?
I think the effort to put one's incredibly complex feelings about a person in writing is the start of trouble for a lot of people. And when we're having our own sensations in our bodies, we can sort of allow them to be complicated. We can allow them to be full of contradiction. We can allow joy and pain and grief and exhilaration to exist side by side. And then something about the act of having to be articulate, having to present a public face, having to sum up another life is incredibly daunting. I don't know if you've had the experience of having to eulogize someone. I was very unexpectedly thrust into that position as a 30-year-old. And I found it an almost impossible task personally, because not only because my experience of the particular person was so rich and complicated, but because of the sense of responsibility to her family, responsibility to the other people in the room. And so that idea that, you know, we have a drive certainly to sum up our experience all the time. I think in daily life, we're constantly doing that. We get home at the end of the day and someone says, how was your day? Or, what did you do today? And it's actually incredibly difficult to do with any kind of fidelity to the actual way our lives happen and the richness of it. And so I think I wanted to, what I was hoping to portray is the way that as soon as we try to move towards language, something incredibly challenging and complicated often happens. And for Jean, and in particular, I think what you were talking about with Jean's nostalgia was something I was really interested in investigating. I was really interested in exploring, do the way we remember dead people kind of naturally tend towards nostalgia because there is a loss, because we are trying to replace something that's missing that we feel poignantly. And so, but I thought, you know, that can't be true. And of course we remember terrible things about people and we, sometimes we even feel relief that they're gone. And so I wanted that to enter the story and to complicate what was going on for Jean.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought you did it really well. So now there's one part that really jumped out at me, and I think it reminded me of how I felt after my mother died. This is a quote from The Dependents. He now reserved a special kind of misery for the sight of a happy couple. This particular human configuration seemed to have been invented to draw out the despair in everyone else. That was such a great, it was so real. And when my, not to get too personal, but when my mother died, I would feel just actual loathing for mothers and daughters when I saw them. I would just feel just absolute resentment. Like, how can this possibly continue to go on? And, you know, to me, this kind of connection with prose is what makes fiction so valuable. You know, it's like the ability to feel less alone, maybe in moments of solitude or despair like that, but even like in the weakness of our character, you know, because I understand that feeling that kind of loathing for strangers that are having a nice day is wrong. but, you know, you can feel in reading that same sentiment in fiction, you can feel a real comfort and a real connection with the rest of humanity. And is this what you hope for as you write a book like this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say I would hope for even one step further, which is to receive some affirmation that thinking those things isn't wrong, in fact. Right. I mean, I remember talking to a dear friend who's a very empathetic, talented psychiatrist, and I was asking her, she had two very young sons, and I was asking her how it was going, balancing her career and raising her boys. And she said, you know, sometimes I really want to murder my children. And I found that so refreshing, because I don't have children of my own, so I don't actually know what it's like to want to murder your children. But she said it with this kind of vigorous wholeheartedness, and the expression of that sentiment itself was a real release of it, and then we could laugh about it. And I do think that particularly in our consumerist society, where our emotions get immediately packaged in certain ways. When someone's grieving, we're supposed to send a certain kind of consolation card. We get messages all the time about what the appropriate way is to respond in especially situations of duress. And I think that actually one of the most powerful things that we can do to offer to other people is just to say, you are allowed to have your experience, whatever it is. And so I think that, you know, Jean doesn't necessarily actually want all the happy couples of the world to immediately dissolve and enter in strife. But there is a kind of, there's a way that just feeling his melancholy and feeling his resentment of other people actually allows him to feel connected to his wife. And I think that that is perfectly okay. You know, I mean, we can't go around murdering our children. That's another story when it crosses over into action. But it's actually really unusual that if we have a feeling of hatred or loathing or self-destructiveness, that there are anyone in our lives who says, you know, it's absolutely fine to have that feeling. And part of having that feeling is actually moving through it. And that's part of what I wanted to look at in the book early on in the first chapter. Is, you know, Jean says that he could never imagine not grieving the way that he is currently grieving, a kind of grief in which he sees his dead wife essentially on every street corner, and he's, you know, obsessed in a certain way with her belongings. And yet, you know, a few months later, he actually is in a very different place in his grief, which doesn't mean that he doesn't feel grief and feel the loss of his wife, but it can be shocking at how quickly one moves through states that feel absolutely permanent at the time.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned the beginning of the novel. So actually, this is kind of a nerdy question, but I loved the opening of the novel. The very first sentence is, his wife had died in June, and there was to be a memorial service for her in 2 weeks at the end of the summer. So I want to talk to you about openings and what makes a good opening. But I also, the very first phrase jumped out at me because it's in the past perfect tense. His wife had died in June. And it's so unusual. You never see a novel open in that tense. It was absolutely right on so many levels. And I almost think maybe you wrote the beginning toward the end of writing the book, but I don't know that. But can we just talk a little bit about openings and what makes a good opening and how you came to yours?
Oh, yeah, I would love to answer that question. Well, your instinct was actually right. That a version of that line that was very similar appeared a bit later in the book early on. And in fact, it appeared originally in the scene where he goes back to the inn to try to write his eulogy. And that line appeared, and it was actually another reader of the book, the writer Kate Walbert, who is another fantastic writer, who pulled out that line and said, this is sort of where all the tension is. This is where all the action is for me. Can we move it earlier in the book? And she didn't say, can it be the first line of the book? But as I was looking at that line, I thought, well, here for me is the predicament that Jean is in. It's not that his wife is dying or just died yesterday. It's that she has died. Something is supposed to happen to him, and he doesn't know what in this interim period that is supposed to allow him to, in 2 weeks' time, be able to say something coherent and intelligent about the person that he has just spent 49 years of his life with and who died incredibly suddenly.
Right.
And I also felt like that was a situation that is actually quite common. I mean, it's a situation in some sense rife with suspense, but it is of the most ordinary kind. People die, and then something else has to happen. The business of life continues, and also I tend to be a fan of first lines that both set up what the situation is, but also do so in relatively simple language, but that portrays an emotionally or psychologically complex situation. And part of just the reason for my affinity for simple language is just to move the reader through it with relative speed so that they want to keep reading.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned that sentence is in the past perfect, but there's so much about that sentence that's really important to the story. And it's like kind of the perfect opening sentence, as your friend sort of pointed out to you. It's a very important sentence, or a lot about the sentence is very relevant to the book. So the memorial service is mentioned, the amount of time he has to work on it. And then just the mention of summer. And summer is so important in this book. And it links to the past and to many, many summers that they had visiting with friends on a lake in New Hampshire. And so just even the mention of summer, I felt like was a very important part of this sentence.
Mm.
And yeah, anyway, I just thought I'd also mention that because I didn't say it before. But
I appreciate you reading so closely and carefully. There's nothing more gratifying as a writer.
Now, let's see. Okay. So in reading some of, I always like to kind of like poke around and look at the reviews of a book while I'm preparing for an interview. And I kept coming across mentions of this same sentence snippet, which has to do with the experience of sorrow and it being a kind of madness. But the paragraph that precedes this observation is what the sentence sort of relies on, and it is absolutely lovely. And so I was going to ask your permission to read it, and then we could talk about it.
Oh, yes, please.
Is that all right? Okay.
Yeah.
He turned down a gravel drive, and there was a boy in a dun-colored uniform coming the other direction, carrying a bicycle over his shoulder. The way he carried it seemed to rob the frame of any weight, and this same quality of weightlessness was born into his body as he mounted the bicycle in the street. He didn't appear to jump and throw his leg over it so much as resume his natural form. The boy's figure grew small against the bushy furrow of trees. It was beautiful how, from a distance, his legs seemed to become part of the bicycle, as if he were spinning his own disappearance, a boy creating a rent in the horizon with that steady circling motion of the wheels, which were also his legs. A nick of silver, a smudge of air. Then the boy was free, on the other side of the visible world. Jean couldn't say why it moved him, and yet there it was, the swollen feeling in his chest. And then the next sentence is, this too was grief, and it was this infusion of it, even more than the suffering, that made the experience of sorrow a kind of madness. I understand why people mention that sentence about the madness, because I think it's really very real and very evocative of a real emotion that people have. But that paragraph about the boy and the bike and how sometimes just the beauty in a normal small moment can really impress itself upon us, and maybe even more in times of heightened emotion. And so I wondered if you remembered writing this paragraph about the boy on the bike. And I also was just personally curious if that was something you saw and took notes about, or if it was an image that you created in your mind.
That image appeared in the very first draft of the book, and the book went through 10 drafts. So I really consider that image a very centering or anchoring image for the book. And it was not something that I had seen in my own life and took notes about. It really, nor did I feel, interestingly, that the image came from me or my experience. It was really the product of Jean's emotional imagination. Mm-hmm. And I felt that the only way that it came through me was really through Jean's grief and through that very strange thing, as you said, that happens when we have some major disturbance in our day-to-day existence, and then all of a sudden everything is a little bit off kilter. You know, the way that light falls against a brick wall, or the smell of a particular food, and it has sometimes a much more direct line to our ability to feel and be moved by those experiences. And I think that, you know, it's no coincidence, and I will say this is something I can only say in hindsight after I wrote the image. It wasn't in my mind at the time, but obviously death is a very mystical experience, right? In some way. We don't know what is happening to the dying person. We don't know what exists on the other side, if anything does. And so for me, this image is very much linked to the mystical experience of undergoing another person's death, and then the way that we can look around our lives and Notice, in fact, that a lot of our lives have a mystical dimension to it, that people are coming in and out, disappearing and appearing, and what we understand about their experiences is incredibly limited. And so that image was there from the beginning, but the language took a little while to get right to at least to my ear. And what was interesting for me about that is that when I first set out to write, I had all kinds of internal rules for myself about what I could and couldn't do. And there was a part of me that was still trying to do things like avoid too much repetition in a particular paragraph of prose. And when I finally just set that aside and said, okay, there are certain words that just are asking to be repeated in this paragraph, like the bicycle and the weight and the legs. And when I allowed myself to actually do what my ear was telling me to do, then the image itself formed and came together. So that was a really interesting experience for me, just in terms of getting to know the way my own imagination works, and that it's not necessarily that the image precedes the words fully formed, but that really the image itself is a fusion of the actual music of the language, mm-hmm. and then the visual element.
Yeah, and it's funny. I think that when words are repeated without intention, that's when they are, I think, distracting in prose to a reader. But I think when words are repeated with intention and with consciousness, then they become sort of like a beat or like a refrain that kind of helps ground things, but only if it's done, you know, artfully and with intention, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I often think of there's a beautiful paragraph in To the Lighthouse, where Mrs. Ramsey talks about the stroke of the lighthouse. And I think you see the word stroke appear something like five times. And the last way that it appears is that she calls the stroke of the lighthouse beam her stroke. Mm. And it's I think one of the most beautiful and moving passages in all of literature where that repetition appears.
Yeah. So now you talked early on about how the story sort of began with a father-daughter relationship in your mind. So let's talk a little bit about the character of, is it Dari or Dari?
Dari.
Dari, okay. So she is Jean and Maida's daughter. So let's just, there's this great conversation that they have. It's very sad to me, actually. They have this conversation in her room about whether or not Maida had been happy and whether or not she'd been able to take pride in having, as Dari puts it, made, built, or envisioned anything of value. That was so sad to me. And there was a lot between them that just, they didn't see the world in the same way. It's almost like they just were operating at slightly different planes, and it kept them from being able to bring their views together in a comfortable way. Anyway, do you want to just talk a little bit about developing Dari's character?
Yeah, you know, I was very conscious of not wanting to portray a father-daughter relationship that was comfortable, as you say,
right.
And in part because my own experience of relationships is that many of them are incredibly uncomfortable, and that discomfort endures in spite of many things, in spite of attempts to improve the relationship, in spite of time passing, in spite of good intentions. And I think that might be depriving certain readers of a kind of satisfaction, because I think, you know, we naturally have a desire for people to work things out, for there to be a kind of harmony. But that just isn't my own experience of what is true to life. And in particular, it seemed to me very realistic that Dari, who has really lived in a different time, a different era than her father, and has received, she's highly educated. Her father has an education, but of a different kind. She's highly educated. She is much more cerebral than her father. She is self-protective in a way that her father doesn't understand. And she's impatient with his tendency towards nostalgia. And I think that they were, you know, I wanted them to be foils to each other without, it was certainly not my desire to make a judgment about who was mourning in the correct way or not. And,
right. And
I think that both of their ways of mourning are valuable. I mean, I think Jean has a desire to resurrect what was positive in the relationship, what was happy, and Derry has a desire to be a truth teller, and her version of the truth is that it has a kind of asperity around the edges, and that's what's true. And I think that, you know, we encounter people in our lives like this, you know, the person who is always looking for the best in a situation, and then the person who feels that in order for us to hew to reality, there has to be some element of difficulty in it. And so when these two characters come together, I don't think they have a desire to be in conflict all the time, but they do struggle to, as you said, align their different viewpoints. And I think that, you know, Derry's concern about what was of value in her mother's life is a very understandable one, given the shift that happened in the way that women's educational opportunities changed and their opportunities to advance in the professional world changed, especially in that period of the 1970s and 80s, when very elite colleges were for the first time opening their doors to a class of very talented women that had been before that time excluded. And I think that there can be a kind of sadness looking at you know, what was lost to a generation of women who didn't have those opportunities and whose primary opportunities were really in supportive roles of, you know, either being teachers or nurses or just in sort of a helper role to the lives of other people. That felt like something I could certainly relate to as a young woman.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely comes through. And actually, you know, I liked the way that you drew their relationship, because although there's a lack of comfort and there's certain tension, there is a desire on each of their parts to do better, right? And
yes.
And that's always there, even when they fail.
Yes. And this idea that you can be in the same room with someone over and over again where it doesn't quite work out, but just showing up in the same room means something.
Right. Yeah. Now, to get back to the eulogy that Jean is trying to write for Maida, he follows advice he finds online, and he goes through her things, hoping to sort of like bring stories to the surface that he can use in his speech. And I thought this was a lovely way of showing the reader a more vivid picture of Maida as well. Some of the objects that he finds are sort of more universal, like the coins that had been in her pocket and the hour and minute she had last set for an alarm. But then his description of other things gives us a lot of opportunity to learn a little bit about each of them. Like his description of her shoes shows us a lot about his passion for his former work, which was he was the owner of a shoe store before it went out of business. And so we learn a lot about his knowledge about shoes. And then this nightgown that he bought for her, we learn why he bought it, but he never shared his reasons with her. And that tells us so much about him too. And anyway, so I wondered if we could just talk a little bit about the importance of objects in prose and vividly drawn objects and how they can carry weight.
Yes. This reminds me of one of the earliest writing exercises I was given by a teacher, which was just that, which was to begin describing an object and to allow that object to lead you to a narrative about a set of characters. And I still think it can be a very powerful exercise because in our day-to-day life, we interact with objects all the time. We sort of think of them as these defined, concrete, fixed things that have a kind of absolute meaning. And then as soon as you start writing about an object, you realize that their meaning is entirely relative, that who picks them up and what a person does with them completely informs the meaning of that object. And that's really the case with the objects that Jean picks up. And the novel is told in a pretty close third person point of view, but one of the advantages of the third person over the first person is that you have a little bit more room to show around the point of view of the character that the story has been narrated through. And this was an opportunity, as you were pointing out, for me to show that what Jean thought about these objects wasn't necessarily exactly the way Maida thought or felt about these objects, mm-hmm. and that if they had picked up the very same object, they probably would have told an entirely different story about them. And so, you know, this nightgown that he bought for Maida and didn't share his reasons why, and that, you know, there's a sadness there. She never wore the nightgown,
right.
And yet she held on to it. She kept it. She didn't get rid of it. And it's something that Jean gravitates towards in this moment. But it also, you know, it says so much about, it starts to say so much about the nature of their marriage, the nature of their sex life, which you learn a little bit more about later in the book,
yeah.
Which was not uncomplicated. And so so I think that objects are this rich repository of learning about the characters in a book. And what's wonderful about it is that you don't have to decide beforehand what the character thinks of the object. I think once you start describing the object, it's a wonderful way to actually get information about who your characters are.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think it works so much better if you let the object lead you towards story rather than taking a story and filling it with objects that seem like they would be appropriate to the story you've written.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so now The Dependence is written in two different timelines, which we haven't talked too much about yet. So you go back and forth in time telling the story of this family. And so I was wondering if it was always like this when you started the book, and if one timeline maybe gave you more trouble than the other, or did you find yourself looking forward to each of these as you worked, like, oh good, now I get to go back in the past, or oh good, now I get to get back into the future. How was that for you?
So the book always had both of the timelines, and I think that for me as the writer, it was really important that the book have both of these timelines, in part to do just what I was speaking about a minute ago, was to show around the edges of Jean's
right.
point of view.
Yeah.
And seeing those scenes from the past was really important to me to learn about the limitations of the way that Jean was viewing his marriage and this question of, you know, how had it been a happy marriage? Was it sort of pristine from the very beginning? And, you know, one of the things that happens very early on in the book is that you learn even on their wedding day, there was a misunderstanding afoot about even where they were to be married.
That was great.
And they only belatedly discovered that neither of them had wanted to get married in a church, though they were married in a church, and that really they had ended up in that place of misunderstanding out of a very sort of sweet desire to please each other, but that fundamentally there was a misunderstanding there right from the beginning. And so those scenes from the past were a very important way for me, and I hope for the reader to modulate Jean's nostalgia, to modulate his tendency to view things in a perhaps overly positive light, especially at the beginning of the novel. And so I think, you know, the challenge for me as a writer was to figure out how to incorporate those scenes in a fairly seamless way. And I knew that I didn't want to have like an entire section of the book that was retrospective. I felt that for the sake of movement through the book, it was important to keep the story rooted in the present day around this story of what was going to happen at the memorial service and then subsequently what was going to happen in the relationship with Jean and Derry as they tried to reformulate their relationship after the death of the person that had been the link between them, essentially. And so that was sort of tricky to find that balance. And I would say it took a number of drafts to get there and certainly a lot of paring down. But I ended up feeling that it worked, and in that the reader does go back to does go between these two periods. But I think that the way that they are linked is really through Jean's point of view, and through the moments when he steps back to look at the past happens quite naturally, because as one is grieving, that is part of the grieving process.
Yeah. But it's so tied up in his character and his basic fundamental personality, I guess. You know, he seems so baffled. And in a way, you know, his whole life has been, I think, a little bit baffling to him. You know, he sort of looks back and realizes, oh, I went into this whole career for this reason. You know, and I feel like it's such a human thing to wonder, like, what might my other path have been? And yet I think that for Jean, he's never realized that he could think about that. And all of a sudden he's having these thoughts that are very disturbing to him because he never really before gave it much thought, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's something that most of us do. I mean, maybe some of us do it earlier than other people, but I think there is such a human tendency to want to explain the way our lives have happened with a rational narrative. Oh, right. I decided this, and then I decided this, and then this is what happened. And, you know, but I look at even my own decision to be a writer, and there was, of course, a lot of voluntariness around that choice and a lot of will and discipline and that sort of thing. But even that I look at, and I look at the way I've explained it to myself, and it actually doesn't really make that much sense to me. I mean, I think there are other things that I could have done with my life or may still do with my life. And I guess part of what this book is just interested in is that very inclination to want to provide a rational explanation for the way we behave, when in fact most of the time we don't have a good sense of what is motivating us and what is pulling us around, and that's sort of that double layer of momentum is something that, you know, I really tried to capture in Jean's point of view, that he is, of course, getting up and going through his days, but there is this emotional undertow that is present almost all of the time that is sometimes completely undermining whatever he's trying to do. And sometimes it's just running parallel to whatever he's trying to do, adding a layer of complexity that when we present ourselves to other people isn't necessarily apparent, but in my at least own day-to-day experience is inseparable from the way that existence happens.
Yeah. Now, I think another thing that points up to us his I called it bafflement. Maybe that's not quite fair, but
I think that's a great word.
So Jean and Maida have these friends, Ed and Gail, and I feel like in particular Ed, being next to Jean in some of these formative scenes from their early life, tell us a lot about Jean as well as a lot about Ed. And there's this great quote, or I'm going to quote it. There's this great line in the book that I thought, oh my God, somebody said this to you at like 2 a.m. after too much wine during your Iowa workshop experience. So Ed says, "The world doesn't need any more writers. Has any writer solved a single problem we know of? I'm going to be a doctor because I want to do something with my life." I thought that was great.
That was entirely a work of fiction. It was my imagination. No one said that to me, but of course, that is a legitimate question I have about about, you know, what does it mean to live a meaningful life? And I hope that in choosing to write a work of fiction that there is something meaningful there, but right. no one can promise me that. And I think it's really that, you know, I do have a desire to live a meaningful life, a purposeful life, a life that brings benefit to other people. And it's, you know, it's just inescapable that we do not get any guarantees about that. And so, yeah, I did want to sort of play with that in a humorous way. Because of course then Gene goes on to sell shoes, which he creates a deep sense of meaning about at the time. And then, as you point out, later says, why exactly did I do that? Right. Why did I spend my life selling shoes to people?
Right. And those scenes were actually very evocative for me, just in helping me remember being a child. I'm older than you are. And it's like, I used to go to shoe stores and get school shoes, you know, in August, and they would fit me for the shoes and tell me where, you know, and fit this and that width, and this is where your ball of your foot is supposed to go. And it was such a, you know, I guess in a way, it made me nostalgic. It was such a lovely time where there was a lot of one-on-one service. It was a lot more expensive, but you weren't going on the internet and just ordering, you know, the most popular pair of Nikes. And yeah, those were great. How did you know about that? That you're too young for that.
So. No, I'm not. I too have memories of going to shoe stores and getting my foot fitted, and just the smells of the leather and the shoe polish. And I think I even got a lollipop certain places where I got, you know, fitted for shoes. But I think in general, this probably says a lot more about my own temperament than anything else, and that I am a person who still, you know, drops off my dry cleaning and has a 20-minute conversation with the person who does the dry cleaning and who knows the person who fixes my shoes and who knows my tailor. And, you know, I really value the services those people provide to me, but I also just value the fact that being in contact with them puts me into contact with a world that I would normally have no reason to encounter. And I think one of the great losses we're experiencing culturally as a result of the internet, and, you know, I think the internet is incredible, like lots of people do, but I do feel like one of the main things we're losing is that it can really allow you to isolate yourself around a kind of person that is just very similar to you, and or who does a very similar vocation as you do. And I think that's a real shame. I think we gain so much by encountering people whose lives look different than our own. And then also to be able to connect over something as simple as, you know, the weather or what's going on with politically in the region or with the sports teams. So that is probably my own nostalgia coming through, and I'm still desperately trying to hang on to it in some way. And so, you know, it's funny because, you know, people often ask me a version of, you know, well, how could you write this this novel from a point of view of a 73-year-old man? And of course, this person isn't me in any way, really, or most ways. But then there are these elements that, of course, are part of me, and that longing for a time where it was not possible to avoid coming into contact with the material sources of your life is something that I think is a real loss for us.
I have one more moment I want to mention from their youth, early on in the timeline when Gene and Maida are still dating. You have this wonderful story about Maida teaching Gene to be a better swimmer, and it's funny, that's very early in the book, and as I read it, I just kind of made a little mental note. I wrote down the page number. It seemed so important to me, and I don't know why, but there's this. So here's the sentence. At any moment, she could have swum off by herself, leaving him behind, and instead she stayed beside him and accepted his limitations as her own. And then, you know, as I read the book, I started to feel so smart. I do think that sentence is so important, that whole thing. And so once again, I'm curious, is this something that you wrote toward the end of writing the book, or was that something that you wrote and maybe it led you toward other things that you wrote into the book?
You know, I don't remember exactly when I wrote that sentence, but of course I was thinking about the nature of love and partnership in general and what it means to really take on another human being as an integral part of your life. And, you know, Gene has no idea what he's thinking when he says that, when he says she took on his limitations as his own. It's sort of in a way like the great understatement of the book, but I think it's also the great understatement of just partnership in general. Yeah. And in that, you know, no one would sign up for partnership of any kind if we actually knew what kind of limitations we were taking on for ourselves. And of course, then there's the flip side that we get so much more than we bargain for, and that both of those things are true. So I don't actually remember when I wrote that particular line, but of course it is indicative of that sort of that double reality of Gene's consciousness, which is that at the time, it seems like this very simple, beautiful thing to him. And of course, as it unfolds through the course of the novel, it's anything but.
Yeah, right. Catherine, I'm wondering, what are you working on now? Or have you started something new? Do you know what the next project will be?
I have started something new, and it is a novel, and it is changing all the time. So I hesitate to say that I know exactly what it will be. But I do find that in spite of a desire to write a book that will be totally different the next time, I think in many ways this book will be very different. But I am really interested in this concept of families that are created by outsiders and insiders, that this idea of people who get thrown together and sort of bound together, not exactly by choice and not only because of blood, and then they end up having to sort of work out the intimate and deep psychological conundrums of their life in very close and very uncomfortable proximity from each other. So I'm starting to write about another household that ends up forming in a rather peculiar way, and sort of what happens to the people in that household as they grow up.
Well, that sounds great. That sounds also like very rich potential for the way you write and the things that preoccupy you. I think that sounds really great.
Thank you.
So what have you read lately, Catherine, that you might recommend to listeners?
I'm reading a couple things, or have read a couple things that I could recommend. One of them is I am in the middle of reading Pond by Claire Louise Bennett, which is a group of the strangest stories I have ever encountered that break, I think, every rule that I had for myself as a writer in terms of how claustrophobic the mood is in these stories, or the way that she will allow herself to write about her experience of reading another work of fiction in the course of the story, and then that becomes the liftoff point for the story. And the one thing I just love is that the way the language in these stories becomes completely unhinged in a way that almost approaches poetry, and does this really amazing job of capturing what I think is that irrational current under all of life that we often try to hide and get away from. So I'm loving those, and I think it's one of the most bizarre and beautiful books I've ever read. And I'm also reading Alice Munro's selected stories, and I will admit that I've been reading them very slowly over the course of 2 years because I don't want to run out of her stories. But I'm just bowled over again and again by the way that she can write about a situation that if you mentioned it, you might think nothing possibly interesting could be happening in that situation, whether it's about, you know, someone going into assisted care because their memory is failing, or a a couple of women taking care of their babies on the beach. And the way that she, through the use of especially voice, just the way that she captures local dialect for writers who are interested in learning how to write dialogue, and I feel like I am still learning how to write dialogue, going back to Monroe again and again, she just does the most skillful things with dialogue in a way that sort of brings this fabulous energy to what you might think of as even the most banal subject. So yeah. those are a couple of the things I'm reading.
Yeah, and the good news about Alice Munro is that as I think you sort of were implying, you can always go back and start again because you're going to get so much more out of it the next time too.
Yeah, exactly.
Like every time I read a story, I get so much out of it, and then I'll read it again and I get something else out of it. Excuse me, or further understand it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had one final question for you, but then you said something during the interview, and now I have a different last question for
Great.
You.
Great.
You referred to certain readers who want comfort and harmony. And I'm just wondering if you have advice for writers, because a lot of the listeners of the show are writers. So do you have advice for writers about maybe balancing a desire to please those readers who want comfort and harmony, and also writing something that's true to your intention, true to your vision, whether or not it provides comfort and harmony?
That's a great question. Well, I think my absolute answer, in the sense, is that you never have to provide harmony and comfort to the reader, even if that's what they're wanting. I actually think the most important thing is that you remain true to your artistic vision and the story you want to tell. And if that involves writing a story that provides no comfort or harmony, I don't think that a writer should have to apologize for that. And I think that's really important to say, especially for writers who might be women, and especially for writers who might be writing about family. Because I think the family is still sacrosanct in American culture. And I actually think it's important that there are stories about families that provide no harmony and no comfort. I will modulate that a little bit by saying, but you know, just as it's not true that all relationships verge towards chaos and violence, it's also not true that all relationships. It's also true that some relationships do grow more harmonious, and that is also something real that happens in life. And so I think that the important thing is that one's characters develop in some way, and that, you know, where they end up is not exactly where they started in the beginning of the book. And that doesn't, for me at least, mean that anyone has an epiphany. They may have an epiphany, but epiphanies are also rare, and what we learn from epiphanies don't last, in my experience. There is an epiphany, and then life continues, and there's plenty of trouble ahead as well. So I think that one way of striking that balance is just to ask yourself, how do my characters change over the course of the book, and do they end up somewhere different from where they started at the beginning?
Yeah, wonderful. That's great. And I won't give away the ending of your book, but I loved that last scene, and I loved that last image. And it just, to me, it did provide comfort and harmony. So,
thank you
say
so
that.
Much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So I just want to mention again, the name of the book is The Dependents, and it's by Catherine Dion, and it's published by Little Brown. And Catherine, I really appreciate your time today. I loved talking to you about this beautiful book.
Oh, I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity, and you asked such wonderful questions.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Catherine Dion. We discussed her new novel, The Dependents, published by Little Brown. You can learn more at catherinedion.com. This week's Write the Book prompt comes from my guest, Catherine Dion, who generously suggested something. This has been useful for her, and it's related to the kinds of stories she's interested in telling. She likes to look around at situations that have, on first glance, nothing interesting going on, a situation or a setup that might at first even seem boring. Then reverse that proposition in your mind. Assume the opposite, that something fascinating is going on, either in the situation or between the people that you're observing. This will give you the chance to look again at something that you initially chose to dismiss. And as Catherine points out, we dismiss things for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes we are fearful of what we see, or we are made uncomfortable by it. So looking again at what we might initially dismiss can offer unexpectedly rich material. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with friends and relatives who aren't in our local listening area, let them know that archived episodes of the show are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also find the podcast site by going through my website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I sort of just said, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.